Joseph Chilton Pierce wondered, are we expressing the miracle nature intended? And if not, why? Joseph is a sage among us, now only through his writings. If you haven't experienced him, Michael Mendisa has done you a great favor. A close friend to Joseph, Michael has written The Life and Insights of Joseph Chilton Pierce, and it can jumpstart your own incredible journey into astonishing capacities. I'm Robin Clare with Tributaries. Michael, we could fill days with accolades about Joseph Chilton Pierce, so I wanted to thank you for distilling both his work and your friendship without diluting his potency.
Well, that's quite a compliment. Thank you. Nobody wants to dilute anything that Joe does, that's for sure.
No, definitely not. What is or was the cornerstone of your friendship?
We met 25 years ago, something like that. And I was actually involved recording the talks and dialogues that Jay Krishnamurti gives in Ojai. And we were indulging in a hot springs near there. So we were doing some baths in the hot springs. And my young son was about 18 months old, and he was there. And somebody came up and said, oh, my, you must have a magical child. And I said, well, what is that? And she said, oh, well, there's this book. It's really great. You should read it. So I picked up Magic Child. And at that time, as a documentary filmmaker, I was drafting a 5-part PBS series on, I don't know how to describe it, on the new opportunities in parenting that it's a brand new world that we're working with, and the school system, the whole structure about human development was opening up. So I was proposing to do a series on that, and I read Magical Child and was greatly relieved because Joe had actually done all the research that I thought that I needed to do, right?
Yes.
So it was truly a great relief. So I tracked him down and met him in San Francisco. And in the first meeting, I described how bonding with the child was not just through the senses, as an external kind of sensory experience, but it was equally or even more telepathic, that there was a resonance that the child was sensitive to who you actually are, like a tuning fork, moment by moment. And so the idea that this inner and outer resonance was a very powerful message. And Joe lit up and he said, well, you know, nobody's really, I've been talking about this for 30 years and nobody's kind of framed it quite this way. And where do we go from here? He basically said. So that started our friendship. So there was a great sense of coherence or sympathy between the things that I was interested in and what he'd been writing about. So we shared a lot of the same interests. David Bohm was a friend of Krishnamurti's, and I knew David Bohm quite well, and Bohm was one of Joe's heroes, so we had that resonance. And Joe studied with Muktananda and went to India, and I had experiences in India, and et cetera, et cetera. So there was a lot that we had in common, and yet we were like father and son. We were a generation apart. So that's the backstory.
Right. And so for me to ask what was or is the cornerstone of your friendship, it became obviously it wasn't a cornerstone. It was a full-on building.
Reciprocity. How do I say it? We shared many of the same fundamental issues and questions and interests. So we were colleagues in that right. I'm not comparing myself to him, but we were colleagues in being interested in these same things. So there was a great deal shared meaning is a nice way of saying it.
Yes.
I use the word that we were like drinking buddies, you know, we were like fraternity brothers in a way. And we would talk to each other about our lives, our loves, our disappointments, our families. We would talk about science. We would talk about meditation. We would talk about all these things that he was writing about. I met him when he was just releasing Evolution Zen, so I didn't go back to the earlier writings. But after Evolution Zen, he would send me drafts or would send me a copy of what he was just about to publish and ask for my opinion and what do I think, et cetera, et cetera. So it was really sweet.
Yes, absolutely. Now, I was surprised. Let's go back a little ways into Joseph's history. But I was surprised when Joseph told me that he had written The Crack in the Cosmic Egg years before it was published. And already when it was published, it was ahead of its time. And did you go back and read that book? I'm assuming you did, in order to write your book, The Life and Insights of Joseph Chilton Pierce. And if so, how did it hold up for you in that reading, even years after it came out?
Well, of course I read it. You know, I would, first of all, I didn't really write the book, the new book on Joe. I'm a filmmaker, so let's say that, I basically edited, I was an editor, and basically 2010, 2011, 12, something like that, I shared with Joe that many people have read one of his books, and perhaps a few people have read more than one of his books, but most have not read all your books. And there was a great need, I felt, for people to see that what he was doing, it was really one book, with each of the books being a chapter in that bigger book, in his life's book, if you want to put it that way.
Yes.
So, and he often said that, you know, what he would do is he would when he wrote the next book, he would try to correct the limitations or the, you know, his greater understanding of what he was presenting in the first book, and then he would go on. So he would go back and make corrections and then push the peg further, push the inquiry further. So each one kind of overlapped in that way. And he also felt a need when he was writing his subsequent books to restate some of the core principles because people may not have read the previous work. So there was this kind of overlap in his writings so that new readers could read the new book as it is, but it had continuity with his past work. So there clearly was this one life story that each of the books were a chapter of. So in tackling this, when I first did my first interview with him, this was, again, when Evolution in Zen was just being done, I asked him, Joe, what is the thread of your life? What's the overarching focus? And he used the term, he used the phrase, to understand our astonishing capacities and self-inflicted limitations. So that's where that phrase came from, which I used as the theme of the new book, this overarching message. It was his phrase. And in structuring this new book, so let's say each of his publications is 300 pages. So I gave myself the task of 30 pages. I said 10%. I need to go and dig in and find 10% of each of the books, because if I did, you know, string those all together, I'm going to end up with a 300-page book. But I can only devote 30 pages to each of his publications, which is not a lot.
Right, but spoken just like a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
tackled yeah, yeah. Like so, a filmmaker.
yeah. So very much so. Yeah, so you could really say that the new book is a documentary on Joe's writings. That's much the nice way of phrasing it. I hadn't thought about that, but that's really what it is.
Yes.
And so my gift or my talent, knowing him so well, was to be able to extract that 10% from the 300 pages, to extract those 30 pages and have it be coherent, have it flow as though it were rather seamless. And then there were something else that we did. In 2010, I brought Joe to Ojai And we had a symposium with about 30, 35 people. And we talked to Joe about why he wrote each of his books, what was going on in his life, and what was the quest of this book compared to the previous one, et cetera. And so those narratives about Joe's personal experience writing became bridges or the foreword to each of the books.
Right.
So the current volume is a blend of Joe's own words about his life and what was going on in his life as he wrote, as well as the extracts from each of his publications, which gives it a very personal and I think wonderful, insightful view of the man and what he was chasing.
Yes, a very fine job you did of that, and it definitely is a wonderful, wonderful read. And to get into some of the more specifics about Joseph and your friendship, which of Joseph's cosmic experiences seemed most profound to you, and do you think it was the same for him, or did he ever tell you?
Well, there were many, as you know. The first one that kindled, no pun intended, that lit the fire for crack was his experience as a young man in his 20s. He was with his buddies in a bar smoking Pall Malls, and he was so engaged with what he was talking about that the cigarette came down and was just about to burn his fingers when his buddy said, "Hey, Joe, you're going to burn yourself." And he says, "Can't burn me." And it didn't. And this was a big deal. So literally the fire is hot enough to melt aluminum at that temperature. So he puffed on the cigarette, and he put it out on his hand, and he put it out on his face, and so on and so forth, and there were no burns, no scars. So fire not burning was the crack. Now, in the title of the book, Crack in the Cosmic Egg, this is a Vedic term. Cosmic egg is a Vedic term to represent our self-world view, which we could really translate into our reality construct. How do we relate to the world? How do we relate innerly and outwardly to the world? That's the cosmic egg. And the insight that Joe had was that this is throughout all of his work, the cosmic egg is an exclusive, subjective and exclusive reality. So when I say exclusive, that also means excluding. It excludes all the potential that isn't in the egg. Right?
Exactly.
So,
yes.
So that's the big aha. And then you have the crack. So the crack is when a phenomena or an experience that is not contained in the egg happens to you. In this case, fire not burning. So that was a crack. Something happened that shouldn't happen given the limitations of our reality, which means that our reality is subjective. It's not, you know, so the reality is what we consider reality, and the laws of nature are subjective. They're not objective.
Right.
And this brings in, you know, the mind-matter relationship, what's going on with that, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the big one. And then he had other things, many other things happen to him that were other manifestations of cracks. And when they did, he chased them down. What is this? How is it working?
Right.
So he used in Evolution's End, for example, the savant. The savant was able to channel, it's the lack of a better word, but not even channeling, that they were able to have access to information that wasn't learned or experienced, and it was infallible and always correct, and et cetera, et cetera. So this was also an example of a crack in the cosmic egg, was the savant.
So. Right. And I'm sure you shared many discussions about freedom, and this is all involved with what you're saying right now, and perhaps you could speak a bit about it involving Joseph's thoughts about how the throwing away of self-preservation sends the ordinary course of events into a whole other realm and lack of constructs so that events could be reversed or changed or modified. And he certainly lived this so much. And I'm wondering if you could expound on that a little bit.
He used the term unconflicted behavior. Unconflicted behavior. So fire not burning would be unconflicted behavior. Some of the other phenomena that he experienced were also unconflicted behavior. The intellect, the neocortex and the intellect with its capacity for memory, its function is to predict and control, to basically identify what's that sound, what is it, is it friend, is it foe, and then to mount a response to it. So that response is fight, flight, or chase after it, or whatever it is. So the neocortex has this implicit, shall we say, conflict or potential conflict built in. So how does the young child, for example, if they're completely safe in their home, if they don't feel threatened in any way, then they're free to explore, to taste, to touch, to embody and build a relationship with everything that they come in contact with. But if the parent comes in and says, no, no, don't do this, or be careful, you're going to poke your eye out, and brings in this fear, conflict, reaction, kind of reflex, then the learning process shuts down. So most of what we call education and enculturation is a closing off of the child's innate learning capacity.
Absolutely.
Shutting it down. We call it parenting, we call it schooling, but it's actually, as I used the word earlier, excluding. You're limiting and narrowing and confining.
Yes.
And of course, there's a place for that, but the real key to human development is to take the lid off rather than keep the shackles on.
Right.
So the main thrust with freedom in Joe's framework is that culture, the whole structure of culture, that can, again, that's parenting, it's the do's and don'ts, it's politically correctness, it's religion, it's the military, it's patriotism, all of these things that are really wrapped up in culture. Put a lid on our limiting and constraining limitations and constraints that we impose on human development to fit into culture, but not to actualize our human potential.
Right.
So here's your conflict between culture, how do I get along in the tribe, and what your innate capacities are. And this bio-cultural conflict, as he used the phrase, is the Achilles heel that's driving us to extinction.
Yes, and what comes to mind for me hearing you say that is also, it's a similar scenario as you have with a young child, as you have with someone on their deathbed. The people that are surrounding them oftentimes are holding so much of their own fears and projecting so much of their own conditioning and their fears, when my guess is the person who's passing has just such another reality going on.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, again, this is a universal thing, you see. So now you have the cosmic egg, this little, which is our self-worldview in culture. And then you have the vast spectrum of potentials that are built into our nature that have been excluded. And, you know, how do you let go with great sensitivity and intelligence into move with the life, with what life is, which is, you know, a metaphor is like a fountain. You know, we are given shape because of the flow of the water that creates the fountain, and it's always flowing and changing. So how do we suspend our intellectual fear driven put the brakes on, as opposed to sitting in the inner tube floating down the river? Now that would be, you know, we want to, nature's way is to float, whereas we're backpedaling and doing all kinds of things
and drowning as a result.
Yeah, right.
Of it, right? And
right.
It's beautiful to see that you have Touch the Future, which is a nonprofit supporting the parent-child relationship and human potential. And as you were just talking about, the space that is nonverbal communication is put into your model.
Well, Touch the Future was because I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I have spent years, 30 years now, meeting not only with Joe, but reaching out to other people like Joe in the field of pre and perinatal psychology, in the roots of violence, in education, in sports, athletics, et cetera, these various fields. So my goal was, you know, basically the vision for Touch the Future is the extended family used to be the learning environment. Joe called it the model imperative. So the extended family, or that small culture or tribe, was how you learn to get along in the world. And after World War II, that extended family collapsed, and it became institutionalized with schooling and all kinds of other things. So moms and dads really lost their direct mentors, and it became a book, or now a video, or then the internet, right? So we,
yes.
but we lost the living models, and now it's several generations down the pike. So we've actually lost the insight that those that the living models used to have. So the new models for parents. Were really the preschool environment, the early child care providers and the midwives and so on. They were the ones who have replaced mother or auntie in the parenting of parents. So Touch the Future was really designed as a curriculum base or a resource base for those providers, the midwives, the child care providers and teachers, or, you know, and so on, so that they would have this wonderful open-ended access to the kinds of vision that Joe's talking about, that Gabor Mate's talking about, Bruce Lipton's there, James Prescott, a lot of other people, Gene Leadlaw, all of these wonderful people, many of which are no longer with us, so that the caregiver would be able to access the vision that these people had as part of the mentoring for parents. And it was intended to help them on a one-to-one basis. It really wasn't designed as a school for parents. It was a resource for the people who were mentoring parents. That's what Touch the Future was designed
Beautiful,
as.
Yes. How did you tap into the energy of imagination and creation for writing your book?
Well, again, it was remarkably easy for me, having spent all this time with him. I reread each of his books, and I just marked the books and the chapters and the paragraphs and the insights within each of those. And again, this is very much what a filmmaker does. A filmmaker shoots all kinds of material, and then they go through it, and this phrase in this clip of this interview was great, and it'll juxtapose with that one over here, so you make those connections. So I've had 40 years of editing experience with film, and it transcribes over to the editing of this kind of material. It's almost, how do you describe it? I don't really do it as an intellectual process. I don't labor over it. It actually speaks to me, right? So when I read this paragraph and I go to the next one, that connection between this statement and that statement is already there on the book, and all I'm doing is making those connections. And it's, like I said, it's not a matter of great analysis. I'm facilitating the process rather than creating the process, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does. And Joe's books, for me, really lend themselves to just having a paragraph or a sentence, even, or possibly a few words, just kind of sends you off into a dreamlike world, right? Because it just creates pause.
Joe's talent was basically like all of the other greats. He challenged, in an awakening way, our preconceptions,
yes.
our dogma, the dogma that we live in, right? We live in dogma. And, you know, we have, and most of what we think is a reflexive kind of thing. The thoughts that we had 50,000 thoughts yesterday, and most of them were the same as the day before. So we're really quite habitual, so what Joe was looking at, these cracks that he was exploring, naturally challenged the dogma that we live in, the habitual dogma that we live in. So that's that dreamlike thing that you're talking about. He opened us to new possibilities and new ways of relating to ourselves and to the world that accessed and helped us develop these excluded potentials. That's really the key here. So by understanding our self-inflicted limitations, which is why we grow up the rather miserable and impoverished human beings that we are, that's the self-inflicted limitations part, which is the way the culture works. But then you have our amazing capacities, which is all of these excluded potentials. And that's really what drove him, was to free us from the shackles of culture, our enculturation, and open us to these vast potentials, which are clearly miraculous.
Yes, they are.
You know, way beyond, you know, in terms of sensitivity, in terms of appropriateness. You know, he would often say that, you know, the intellect, because of its rather cut off nature, it's abstracted. The intellect is abstract. So its abstracted nature is isolated and cut off from the appropriateness of the whole, or the appropriateness. The intellect says, is it possible? And Joe would say, if it is, let's go for it and make some money off of it. But is it appropriate, which is the intelligence of compassion or the heart that he talked about.
Right,
so
yes.
We need to integrate those. We need intellect that is grounded in appropriateness, and that's what's missing.
Yeah. And I'd like to close with a final quote from Mr. Pierce, and it is, God works and man plays, and I like that.
Yeah, no doubt. Yes, indeed.
Michael Mendisa, thank you. And for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to run an interview I had with Joseph Chilton Pierce from 2012. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com, and podcasts are found in their likely places. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned. And Joseph, I wouldn't put it past you to be listening, so thank you for turning more than a few heads toward the light.